Welcome back to another episode of Questionable Personalities. We're here with Jason Mangano. He is an author, a police officer, and formerly a lot of other things that I think we'll get into eventually. Hi, Jason.
Hi.
Good to have you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And a puppy dog is back.
Duncan. So
he'll probably, yeah, knock the camera down.
At least he's not a cat. He can't go on the table. Or sure can he?
No, he just pushes his face on everything.
All right, do you want to
keep
going? Or?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
I don't care. He's going to be here.
I was going to say, where we could have him go up in the other room. He was good until the camera started rolling.
And so then, we should turn the camera on him.
Yeah.
The dog is...
totally.
Well, he might kick the camera, but we'll see what happens. I guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah. It's a fly-by-night episode. Outfit. All right. So we'll start, I guess, with the book, since that's your big new current project. And then we can go back and, you know, talk about, you know, references and influences and stuff like that.
Okay.
Book's about terrorism, right? I mean, I read a little bit about it.
It starts with terrorism.
It's about a lot of things. Can you see it?
Yeah, you can see it.
Can bring it up.
Sure. There you go. That's better. But it starts off at the Times Square.
Yes, it starts off with a terrorist attack on Times Square. There's a terrorist organization which is getting worse and worse and worse. And it eventually gets its wish by dragging the rest of the world into kind of a global conflict, like another world war, with a united Muslim army against the Western allies. And what happens from there is the military, due to their fighting overseas against superior numbers on foreign territory, they're starting to lose ground. And to compensate for that, they come up with an injection which temporarily resurrects dead soldiers on the battlefield. And the purpose is really to recycle the soldiers that die so that new ones don't have to die. And this way, when someone goes down in battle, rather than send a whole new platoon in there and having them all get wiped out, the medics go out, inject these people, they wake up, they're fierce, they're aggressive, basically intolerant to pain or damage, and they go in and kind of help to win the battle without sending in a whole bunch of new other lives to get lost. So they kind of like, that's as the heroic dead, they're kind of the heroes. They basically save the lives of all the presently living Marines.
So are there like zombie soldiers? Is that what, or not exactly?
Kind of. I always hate to use the word zombie because they're not the gut munching, you know, I bite you, you turn into a zombie and infect everyone.
Yeah.
It's a military injection, which is given to the dead soldiers. And for a couple hours, they're back in the fight, and then it wears off. But they are fully conscious. They're not these mindless zombies like you see in other movies. They're fully coherent. They're just hyper aggressive and extremely resistant to gunfire and whatever else they run into.
Yeah, and quite angry.
So technically, I guess they are zombies. They're undead, but they're not the mindless gut munchers that, that you see.
Yeah, zombies has really changed.
Yeah, I would try to get away from that. That's been really overplayed. So it's a new take on an old genre.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then what happens to? Because I didn't finish reading it. I read as much as I could before we
did
this.
I did.
So I don't know.
We don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, you don't want to give away the ending. But I'm curious to know what happens with the soldier like that if he gets shot again.
Well, once you've been injected, you were, like I said, it's only for a couple hours, but you are at least temporarily unstoppable. I mean, unless you blow someone to bits or blow their head off or something like that. I mean, they can take gunfire. They can take stabbings. They can take like losing a limb even. And they'll keep going. You don't need all the normal facilities you would need as a regular soldier. But then ultimately it does wear off and then you're gone for good. But for a short time, you do get back into the fight. And since they are extremely aggressive and unstoppable, it doesn't really take a lot of them to turn the tide of a battle.
Seem very practical.
It's
recycling.
Yeah, it is
almost like how they used to describe people on PCP.
In a way.
Except, you know, you can't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is practical. And like I said, you don't lose other lives. You just recycle the ones that have already been killed.
Yeah.
However, what the book really focuses on is the moral aspect. You know, does the end justify the means? The protagonist in the story, his name is Job Tillman, and he's a pastor's son. He's kind of a pacifist, and it's really his inner struggle about the morality of, you know, is it an abomination to God, or is it, you know, the Savior?
Yeah.
You know, is it the key to victory or damnation? Basically, is it really the moral dilemma?
Yeah, I find that interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and the people in his platoon, some of them have a quite different take on it.
Yeah, because he joins almost out of a sense of obligation, right?
Yes. Yeah, he loses his brother in the Times Square bombing in the first chapter. And he just really feels like he has to do something, even though he's kind of a pacifist and he's never really been a fighter.
Yeah.
He just feels like he has to do something. Someone has to take a stand. And the Marines, as they are good at, is bringing that inner aggression out of you. You know, they kind of, you know, they teach him to summon his inner demons.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's in some ways it reminds me a little bit, as I was reading it, of Full Metal Jacket, because there's that time in training, and then it moves into the action.
Full Metal Jacket was definitely an influence when writing those scenes.
I'm glad I caught that.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That's one of my favorite movies, especially the part where they're in training.
Right.
So
yeah.
I tried to tap in, you know, to that, at least when they're in training. I've done a lot of tactical training, like through the police, like on being on SWAT, and I went through sniper school at Fort Dix, but I've never been in the military. So a lot of what I got was from movies. So I did need a little bit of help from some of the guys I work with who are Marines, because they have their own lingo.
Yeah.
And if you don't use their words, they know.
Right.
And it's almost insulting to them. So my first draft, I made sure I gave it to a Marine right away, and he told me what they would or wouldn't say, and then I immediately did the edit to correct those things.
Yeah. And they even had the, I don't know what they call it, but when they're marching and they have
their cadence.
Their cadence, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of fun to write.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I had to come up with new cadences since I haven't been through the military. And it was kind of fun.
Yeah.
So what was the feedback from the colleagues that you have who actually have that background?
They really enjoyed it. Actually, so far, everyone who's read the book, all my friends and family, have given me really, really good reviews. They've told me that they really like it. They actually want me to write a sequel, or at least hope that it becomes a movie. I've also, on Amazon, I've gotten all 5 out of 5 stars, except for one. I got 4 out of 5. I submitted it to Literary Titan. They gave me 4 out of 4 stars, and they actually gave me their gold medal award for excellence. They put me in their Book of the Year competition. So at the end of this year, hopefully I'll have some good news, because that would go a long way for marketing if I actually were to win that. But I did get the gold medal award, and then I kind of, because of the good feedback I got with Literary Titan, I submitted it to Online Book Club, which has over 1 million members. And I got 4 out of 4 stars there as well. And I got some really just great reviews. You know, they've described it as riveting, captivating, you know, like a page turner, something you couldn't put down from beginning to end. It just hasn't materialized in a lot of sales, but the reviews have been great.
Okay, well, that's a good say. Yeah. Did you self-publish? Or did you,
yes, okay. It's self-published. I'm trying now to get a literary agent, just because I think writing the book was easier than marketing it. I mean, unless you're willing to throw the money into it and put the time, it's hard to get the sale. So I'm going to try to find an agent now. I just started on that quest. And then from there, they can really help you to get in front of the right people.
Well, that seems to be the case, because if you're into marketing, you're into marketing, but you don't have both. It's very hard. Right. I mean, some people do. They're lucky few.
Yeah, it either takes a lot of money or a lot of savvy with social media and the internet. I really don't have that.
So right now, the only place to get this is Amazon?
No, basically any online retailer. So it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, like Alibris, things like that. Pretty much any of the big online retailers. But also, because of the distributor that I go through, any bookstore can order it as well. So if you went to your local bookstore, they're probably not going to have it on the shelves, but they can order it and have it in within a couple of days.
Okay. And so how did you come up with this idea? What was the impetus to get started?
Yeah. Was there a single, like, inspiration or?
Not really. I mean, I tried to put some social commentary into the book and tried to, you know, ask those big questions and, you know, have people reflect on things in society. But the reason I wrote the book is not quite so lofty. I was drinking with friends. And, you know, as you do when you start talking about movies and, you know, like, what if a movie was like this? And I started talking about an idea, And the more we drank and the more we hung out, like I started coming up with more and more details. And you're like, that would make a great movie. And it, you know, with every drink, the details flow a little bit more. And then rather than just forget about it the next day, I actually just got up the next morning and just started writing. And it went pretty quickly. I originally wrote it as a screenplay because that's what I originally pictured as, was a movie. I did that back in 2012, actually. So it was a long time ago. I wrote it. I tried really hard to get it in front of production houses, and they don't take unsolicited material unless it's from an agent. Send letters to agents, and they don't take unsolicited material unless it comes from, you know, unless it's got a big buzz going on.
Catch 22.
Right.
Yeah. You have to get it to a well-known actor.
Right. Exactly. And I don't know any. basically someone said, well, why don't you convert it into a novel? And then if you actually start to sell some copies, it might be easier to get in the door with those other places. So after a number of years of just kind of sitting on it, I converted it into a novel, and it's been out for about a year now, a little bit less than a year.
And did you write anything before? Or is this
no,
first?
This is
the first. So you went straight to the novel.
This is the first
no
thing.
No short stories, no poems, just straight to the...
Nothing at all. I literally just, I had an idea, and I'm like, that would make a great movie. I think someone needs to hear about it. And I just started writing, and just, it took a little bit of research, you know, to come up with some of the things that are in the book so that they were accurate. You don't want to just fudge things because people will know. Like I said, yeah, writing it wasn't that bad. I just, it kind of just started flowing once I started going.
Did you start with the story first or the characters?
The story. Yeah, I started with the story first. I really had a good idea of what I wanted to do. And the big part of drinking with my friends that night was we were really talking about not doing a movie like everything else in Hollywood. It seems like there's not a lot of original stories anymore. A lot of them are remakes. So it's just, you know, we'll do this movie, then we'll do part 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We'll remake old movies from the 70s and 80s. A lot of them have the same type of heroes, the same type of endings. And I wanted this to be kind of an alternate hero that you're not going to find in other things. I didn't want to give it also that same kind of happy ending where, you know, the good guys win at the end and everything is peachy keen. I feel like that's kind of played out. People kind of expect it. And I think people can appreciate when an ending is not something they see every day. Kind of like why some people like, well, most people, I think, like Empire Strikes Back over some of the other Star Wars movies. Mm. It was a darker ending. The good guys just don't, you know, it's not all just happy at the end.
Yeah.
I think people can appreciate that and they want to see something a little bit different. And that's what I tried to go with. I tried to take the genres that are out there that are popular, but change them so it's a new take that no one has ever taken before.
And what's, without giving it away the ending, because that's always hard to talk about your film story, and it's like, well, why bother reading it? You just tell me what the thing is about. What is the message of the book without giving away the ending? What do you think the biggest lesson or maybe
like I said,
what do you want people to get out of it?
It deals with the morality of war. Like I said, you know, this is not the first time, as if this were real, this is not the first time in history that people have created a horrific weapon to end a war, like the atomic bomb. It was, you know, a horrible thing, killed 100,000 people in one shot and then probably another million over time, but it did end the war. It ended a lot of bloodshed very quickly. That's kind of normal in a war. So it does an end justify the means, you know, just coming up with this horrific weapon, which has all these evils to it. If it ends the war and saves lives, is it right or wrong? It also touches on, even if a war does end and everyone sees the benefit and everyone sees, you know, the benefit of peace, there are always people out there that are never going to let that happen. There are always people that are going to, you know, going to put the kibosh on that and, you know, and want to see that conflict, want to see that kind of strife continue for whatever reason. Sorry about the dog.
The dog back in the camera. I think a lot of episodes we have a cat or a dog.
Yeah.
That just pop in, which is fine. As long as people don't mind an extra noise and maybe him knocking the camera down.
Yeah. Hopefully he won't knock the camera.
Yeah, let's hope not. So you don't really, you want people to think about it. You're not telling them what to think, but you want them to think.
Right. I try not to tell them what is right or wrong in the decisions that are made in the book. I try to portray both sides between Job and his platoon members, between even the allies and or a number of scenes with from the people on the Muslim army's point of view. And I try to portray the good and bad in each and kind of let people see the good and bad in each and then make a decision for themselves, you know, what's really going on and you know, what is right and wrong.
And the opening sequence is the one, or you know, not sequence, it's not a movie, the chapter.
Yeah.
Not a movie yet. The terrorist attack at Times Square, which is always a target. I mean, that's why they have such high security. I'm sure you know as a mm-hmm. police officer what goes into securing something that huge. And it would certainly be a huge target. I can't imagine that they're not looking at that as a potential, you know, because everyone's watching it all over the world. So if you want to make a message of some sort, right. horrible one, I'm sure that's why we have such high security. So
yeah, anything like that, Super Bowls, any kind of big festival, Times Square, those are all huge things which would be targets. And the book just addresses, you know, what if, because obviously that's going to get emotions flaring. People are going to want payback, you know, if there's something like that, just like with 9/11.
Yeah, no, that's
something you can't stand for, and it has much larger consequences than just that one action.
Yeah, it's one action multiplied many times.
Yeah.
So what did you do anything creative before writing, or what kind of career path did you take to get to this point? I know Alex told me that it's a zigzag, as most of us go through.
It's a lot of zigzagging. I went to an all-boys Catholic school for high school, which is where I kind of, I guess, what piqued my interest in like mythology and religion and things like that, because you do have to take several classes in that. But then after that, I went to a large college. I went to West Virginia University as a finance major. I was going to graduate in 92, and that was a recession at the time. So everyone's like, you're never going to find a job, and you can go through this every so often. So I thought, well, what's steady? Death and taxes. I know I didn't like accounting because I already took those classes and I hated it. I've always been kind of like a stoic person. I know death didn't really bother me. So I went, after I graduated with my degree, I went back to Mercer County Community College, which is the only school in New Jersey that does funeral service. And I became a funeral director. I did that for several years. I really wanted to open my own. I realized that wasn't really going to be a possibility because it's cost so much to open one. Mm. It was going to be a long, long time before that ever happened. So I just decided to go back to my major, and I did a bunch of jobs, insurance, mortgages, anything in the financial field. I was a commodity broker. And all of those companies went out of business. Everyone, one after another.
Is that because of you?
No. I was starting to think it was. I mean, basically, I worked for like 8 or 9 companies. They all went under when I was working for them. And I just kept having to switch. And I would work myself up becoming like their number one salesman. But then the company would be out of business. So then I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to pick, instead of these small companies and, you know, start at the ground floor, I'm going to pick a giant of industry, one that's already well established. I'll just work my way up, you know, and try to be the best I can that way. Mm-hmm. And I picked WorldCom. I don't know if you...
I remember the name.
Yeah. It's like Enron. It was a big... It turned out to be like a huge stock scandal. Like it was a farce. So I was like, you know, I picked the right company here. I was actually on a mega yacht with Bernie Ebbers, who was the 15th richest man in the world. He was one who owned... WorldCom. It was the second largest telecommunication company in the world. We were cruising around Manhattan smoking cigars. He's telling us how we're all going to be rich. And I'm like, I finally did it. I finally picked the right company. And then overnight, all my stock options were worth nothing. The company was out of business. Bernie went to jail. I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
A lot of Bernies do that.
I know, dude. That's the name, right? You don't want to be a thing. Bernie in finance. Those yeah. Don't mix.
I should have caught the signs there. But yeah, so that went under. I went into mortgages. I started my own business. I spent everything I had to open it. And then 6 months after I opened the doors, the mortgage bubble and real estate bubble burst. Mm. And I lost that business. So then I...
What year was that?
That was 2006.
Oh, okay. So the recent
recession. Yeah, that was that big bubble that burst. Luckily, right as I was about to declare bankruptcy, because I couldn't even do any loans because none of the retailers or wholesalers were doing it, I got an offer from a sheriff's department in Northern Jersey. I jumped on it because I'd already been looking into that. You know, I figured go to like a job I really wanted, something I would really enjoy rather than just chase the money. So I went with the sheriff's office and I tried to, again, try to be the best I could there. I specialized. I made it onto SWAT. I went to sniper school. They sent me to CBURN certification and explosives classes. I made myself valuable, and about 5 years in, I got laid off. even the most stable job you could think of, I got laid off.
I'm going to move away.
Yeah. So even when I interviewed at the department I'm with now, they were saying, like, you know, so if we hire you, like, are we in danger? Is this gonna... But luckily, the town I work in, it's been going well, and I've been at the same job ever since as a police officer. I'm hoping that that things don't go wrong.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, it's been a long road, but I finally found a home, and I enjoy what I do now, like, and it seems to be stable. So
how different is that for you, being a police officer, going from finance major to police work that probably wasn't in your plans back in college?
No, I didn't even think about it until years after college. I had a number of sales jobs, like insurance and things like that, and mortgages, but I always hated sales. I didn't like finance that much either. That's what I had my degree in. And you know, like, when you meet someone, the first thing you always say is, you know, oh, how's work going? Mm-hmm. And I find for a lot of times it's a formality. You're really just asking to be nice.
Yeah.
But the only one I really wanted to know and, you know, hear the stories was one of my best friends, who was a state trooper. I actually wanted to hear what his stories were, because they were, I'm like, well, and then what happened? You know, like, I got really into it. So after a couple of years, he was like, why don't you just do what I do? You know, obviously you're into it. And it took another probably 2 years before I really, you know, ate the red pill. And I'm like, oh, you know what? Mm-hmm. This is what I want to do. So I switched over. And it's easier than chasing the money, you know, and always, you know, looking, you know, to become a millionaire, the next big thing. It's a more stable job. You're not going to become a millionaire as a police officer, but it's stable, and it's fun work, and it's also rewarding work.
Whereas, good benefits.
Yeah, and you don't get that from, you know, this financial sales as much. Yeah. The rewarding part.
And you're in a fairly small town. Quiet town, at least, right?
Medium-sized town, as far as population. Huge as far as land.
Yeah.
Well. It's about three times the size of Manhattan. So yeah. We each have a huge area that we have to cover. Mm-hmm.
Just because right now, you know, going to police work could be good, could be troublesome.
I'm glad I'm not working in one of the big cities.
Yeah.
In our town, it's great. We have the full support of the community.
Yeah.
You know, they like us there. They appreciate us there. There are a couple people that don't, but usually those are the ones that we've arrested multiple times.
Yeah.
Of course, they don't like us.
They're not going to be happy.
Yeah, they're never going to be happy with us. But
the whole idea of defunding the police is insane. It's like when you see what happened in Indianapolis, all of a sudden they don't hire more cops because they realize, well, what's going to happen when you defund the police? But the crime's going to go up. It's not like...
I would agree with more training.
Well, exactly.
You know, that's more
training.
I understand if they want us to be better at what we do and fix issues that there are, but... I don't think defunding anything is going to be the answer.
I think what they wanted was diversifying the police, because they wanted, like, you know, social workers and stuff to be able to go out and
well, if somebody's chasing me with a knife or a gun, that's what I'm going to call a social worker.
Yeah, I think you're going to see buddy cop movies coming out where, you know, one's the gruff, tough cop, you know, law enforcement guy, the other one's the social worker, and, you know.
That's a good idea. I might write that next year. That's a great idea.
You got the experience there.
That's actually a really good idea.
What's his name? Jocko Willing?
He
had a great idea that they should probably give you 20% of your time just for training, like they do with the, you know, SEALs. Because you spend 80% working, but then 20%, like one day out of week, just doing jujitsu or, you know, negotiation tactics, whatever. And it makes total sense. And of course, it would require you to hire more people, because now the 80% you work in 20 training, and that would make total sense.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's a hard job. Most people don't want to do it, and they appreciate it only when they need it. But when they don't need it, it's kind of like, there's a cop pulled me over, got a speeding ticket or whatever.
The social worker on staff wouldn't be a bad idea to deal with people with mental challenges.
Certainly.
That will be great until the first social worker gets really hurt.
Yeah.
You know,
we
do have classes that we've had to take. Everyone in the department is eventually going to have to take it. I was one of the first ones from my department to be sent, but it's half law enforcement and half social workers. And what they do is they try to give you scenarios and have the other side learn how the other side would handle it and what their thinking would be on it. And the most enjoyable part of that for me as law enforcement was they were like, all right, show of hands for social workers. Who thinks cops are a little too quick to go hands-on with people and to get rough? And every social worker raised their hand. Like, great, we're gonna do an exercise. And they had the 18-year-old son of the instructor sit in the middle of the room, like, okay, he's done something bad, he's under arrest. Just the social workers. Arrest him. He's under arrest. You know, and they try to touch him, and of course, you know, he freaks out and stuff like that. And they just keep trying to be nice and try to reason with him. And he just, you know, yeah, and just going crazy. Until eventually they get to the point where they're like, all right, we give up. we don't know what to do from here. And they're like, all right, cops, who's ever gone through this? And they're like, oh God, me. Like every day. Like, yeah, people just, they don't just listen to reason and give up. That happens very rarely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're in that position because they're not reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. You're totally right also by saying, like, sure, they probably should have somebody on staff as well dealing with that, because occasionally maybe they can talk them down or use de-escalation techniques, which maybe that's something that needs to be more part of the training.
Yeah, I think we could definitely use more training in that, and having a social worker might help as well. I mean, they're going to have far more training than we could possibly get, because we still have to do our other job, but that is their job. We'll see. Who knows? Maybe that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I think jiu-jitsu training would be something, you know, how to disarm someone, or how to, because a lot of times you see these cops and they're just not able to handle physically the other person.
Yeah.
Even two of them sometimes you see stuff. Yeah. And you go like, well, maybe if you train every single week, 2-3 hours, you'll be able to handle something like that versus reaching for
the only thing weapon. Is jiu-jitsu is a lot of choke holds and arm bars, and
if it's done safely, you can't choke. And that's the crazy part to me. Because I've been choked out so many times.
You get
judo and years ago, but it's actually a safe technique if you know how to do it. Because as soon as somebody is out, you know everything kind of goes dark, but you know where to stop. Even if they're not tapping out, you're rolling with somebody, you stop. And it's very easy to see. Like, now, but if you don't know what you're doing, you never did it, you're just going to grab somebody.
Yeah.
That can be a problem because you have no idea what you're doing. But if you're used to doing it all the time, you can recognize the signs. So you can incapacitate them, and then you can...
And you don't have to resort to kicking and punching.
Yeah, it's actually much safer than to just go to sleep. And you can handcuff them and you're good.
Yep.
But...
I agree. I agree with you.
Yeah, because it's like a knee-jerk reaction. It's like, oh, we're being interesting. Wow. That's probably not the exact answer that you want.
Yeah.
You know, prevent horrible things, but a safer way to do stuff.
Yeah. I was actually disappointed to hear about how little some departments even devote to their firearms training. That's my segue into, hey, you've had a lot of firearms training.
Yes. I'm actually, when you were going to say that, like, yes, we definitely don't put a lot of times into firearms. I'm one of the firearms instructors.
Yeah.
And basically the guys shoot once every 6 months.
Yeah.
You do your qualification day and then that's it. And then the gun goes in the holster and it sits there.
Yeah, I've heard that
until 6 months later.
Departments like New York City deliberately purchase their handguns to have a heavy, very heavy trigger pull so that they didn't have, people that were not trained enough accidentally,
You won't get as many shots. The only problem is with the heavy trigger pull, you lose a lot of accuracy, especially in a stressful situation, because now you're squeezing and the gun is going all over.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I've heard. And that's why you get a lot of misses.
Well, they say police will hit about 1 out of every 10 shots in stress situations, because it's not like shooting paper on qualifications.
Yeah.
The paper's not shooting back. There's no stress. But when you're in the field, you actually usually, if a police officer is shooting, it's because they've been shot at first, or at least in many cases. So you're just drawing and firing as fast as you can because it's already coming at you. So it just, you're not really lining up the sights. You're just kind of in that general direction. You're trying to get something while you retreat to safety. And there's a lot of missed shots. At least some of that would help with more training. I mean, you're still going to always have that pressure situation you're not used to. People are going to be retreating and firing. But at the same time, every 6 months is not exactly making the best shots.
Yeah.
It's way less than optimal. Probably weekly training would make more sense.
Yeah.
And you hope they never use it. You can retire and never use your weapon.
And now bullets are expensive. So I don't think anyone's going to be going to more than every 6 months. It's really crazy how much the rounds have cost.
See, Chris Rock was ahead of his time.
Yeah, he saw the future. Yep.
It's like, make a bullet for $4,000. You stop a lot of murder.
Better be a very effective bullet.
That's right.
But I'm kind of fascinated with, you know, the, you told me a little bit other times about Sniper Camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that, because I'm fascinated with it. And a lot of people, you know, they see movies and stuff, and they're like, oh, and they see, you know, a rifle with a scope on it, and they're like, oh, it's a sniper rifle.
Right.
And, you know.
A lot of people, they don't know a lot about guns.
Yeah, exactly.
Unlike municipal departments that don't do a lot of training, I've got a hand in the federal government does it right. When I went through sniper school, it was through the FBI, and it was at Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
And the training there was phenomenal. I mean, that's a legitimate school. They really do it right. They have all the facilities that you would need. They have, you know, more than enough trainers, you know, to work with people individually. They even had one, it was a ghost town. They actually have a town that they built with a bunch of buildings, but the buildings are empty. But there's gas stations, banks, convenience stores, everything. And they had the FBI recruits be the town members as we did our exercise. And they would drive around this fake town or walk around, stand on street corners, and they would give us a scenario. And we had to learn to build urban blinds, so we'd be hidden up in the windows and just watch through the scope and see what was going on. If it was a weapon of mass destruction sale or whatever, we had to kind of pretend like we were doing surveillance and so forth. I mean, you could never get that kind of in-depth training at a municipal department. We obviously can't build a fake town, but they could. And they had more than enough room to shoot long distance. We shot from every kind of different elevation, from in vehicles. I mean, you name it. We did it there. It was a great school.
There's I guess it's a mix of technical and, from what you told me, torture.
Yeah. That was the big gripe that we had with it. It was August. It was 95 degrees every day and humid. And they ran it like as if it was a special forces kind of class. I mean, it was a lot of PT and a lot of team building. So we would wind up running 5 miles through sand, you know, with our rifles. And we're like, we're snipers. We just lay there. You know, like we're never going to have to do the running 5 miles. Like, that's not what we do.
You're trained to be a sloth.
Right. We just sit there, like, you know, with leaves on our heads and just, you know, don't move for hours. But yeah, they really, you know, they wanted you to feel when you left there, like you had really gone through something. Like you would really graduate from something big. Then once I got on the job, I was already on the job, but once I actually started doing like sniper work, it was much more what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Basically, I realized why a lot of people don't want to specialize as sniper on SWAT, because you're the first one out and the last one in.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is waiting in the warm truck, waiting for the go sign to kick down a door. You've already been out for 2 hours lying on the cold ground. And then when everyone comes in, you're still the last one because you're the eyes and ears for the
thing.
So basically just lying there covered in twigs and leaves for, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. I've even done that in a snowstorm where I had, you know, 2 inches of snow build up on me as I sat there.
Staying on target for the whole time. And
The best you can.
Yeah.
Full asleep.
Yeah.
I, that's the thing. I think about it and be like, oh, it's easy. You just stare at there. But, you know, bugs crawling on you. You can't like, twitch that much.
And the heat, you really fall asleep. Because at sniper school, that was one of the drills, is they're like, okay, we're going to have the target pop up. You don't know when, just be ready. And then what they do is, we sat there for 45 minutes and nothing popped up, and it's 95 degree heat just pounding on you. And just people going like, you know, your heads are bobbing.
Yeah.
And then of course they flash the target for 2 seconds and then it's gone. You're like, missed it. And then, you know, then you're doing push-ups for another hour. And
Was it Arlie Army?
Yeah.
He passed away.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the way they did it. It's, they were rough on you if you made a mistake. They really wanted to instill in you mistakes are important. And it was bad. The one time we did a couple mile run through sand, and they said, when you get done with this run, you're going to run right back to your rifle, get down, load up a round, fire your shot. You have 30 seconds. And we'd run for miles. So I ran, jumped down on my mat, got on my rifle, grabbed a round, and I realized that one of the instructors had hidden the bolt. out of my rifle. And I was like, oh. So I started ripping through my bag and looking everywhere. And like, and eventually I got up, I looked under my mat, and there was the bolt. So I put it in really quick. I racked around and I just rattled up a shot as fast as I could. And I remember hitting, looking through a scope. I'm like, bullseye, yes. And then as the instructor was going there, he goes, all right. And he goes, that one has a hole in it. That one has a hole in it. This one has no holes in it. But the one next to it has two. I wonder what happened with there. I'm like, oh. So then he's like, what do you think happened? I'm like, I shot the wrong target. So he's like, you shot. You know, what if that was a civilian? What if that? And then it was, he tortured all of us for about an hour straight of just push-ups and holding plank position. Just to let you know, you don't ever shoot the wrong target. So yeah, I learned. I didn't do that again.
At least it wasn't a little baby carriage. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's, they would just give you little things like, you know, like the 20 targets lined up and they're all 100 and 200 yards away. It's real easy to shoot the wrong one. I think they were just waiting for it, I think.
Yeah,
I'm sure. That was the idea to fluster me. I just wish it wasn't my bolt that they took.
So how long was the training?
It was 3 weeks.
Okay, well, that's
3 weeks in the heat. Yeah,
yeah, it was a long time. We had two guys, I believe, that were kicked out for heat exhaustion. Ambulance came, took them away, and that was it. You don't get to come back. They made it tough. I mean, there were times where your whole uniform looked like you had just jumped in a pool. You know, in your chair when you got up, literally the butt weld in the chair was just filled with like a half inch of sweat.
Butt
sweat. Yeah, it was nasty. Convenient. And you get up the next day and do it over again.
Did you, I guess it's a pretty good chance of dehydration. So did you have access to water?
Yeah, well, you had to bring it and you brought a lot. You just brought gallons with you, and just anytime you got a chance, you had to hit it.
Yeah, because a lot of times if you're stuck somewhere, you might not have any water.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could always, I mean, if you were really that long on a call, you could have someone, come out to you and maybe like, sneak some water out to you. Where we were, we always tried to stay somewhere like you couldn't really be seen. Maybe either behind bushes or something.
Why is this guy delivering a gallon of water to a bush?
Yeah, you try not to be seen.
Yeah, I was just watering.
But yeah, I never actually needed any on a call because usually it wasn't 95 degrees. But like, a lot of times it's nighttime, so it's not as bad. But you're out there for a while though.
Do you do a lot of surveillance or is that not part of what you do?
Well, we do surveillance in the case that we're kind of the eyes for the team. We sit further away. Preferably an elevated position, but we're the eyes for the entire team because a lot of times the team is stacked up against the house, so they can't really see what's going on the other window. So we just sit far away and just kind of monitor the whole thing and feed information. The other job is obviously to protect the team. If someone does show up at a window with a gun or something like that, then you might actually have to shoot. And then what people really know the snipers as and think is hostage situations. Which we would have those, but unfortunately I never had to shoot any of the hostage takers like that. Usually they keep them inside the house further away and the negotiators do their job and get everyone out safely. And then maybe another couple hours later, the suspect will come out.
How many hostage situations were you ever in?
I don't know exactly how many. I mean, it wasn't too many, only a few. And like I say, it's just a lot of negotiation. Usually it was someone just threatening to take bigger action, like threatening to kill cops or threatening to kill his family or threatening to kill himself. And he's barricaded in his house with a bunch of guns. Barricaded subjects are much more common. And those have gotten just as hairy though, because you don't know what they have in there, but sometimes people will tell you what they have in and they kind of overestimate, they'll say like they have grenades, they have this and that, and you're like, oh, here we go. Yeah.
The garage is a cannon. Yeah.
There was actually one call before I got in the team, though. I wasn't on this call. Luckily, someone had a bad feeling. They lured the guy out of the house just because of a bad feeling. They basically told him that his sister was in the hospital. He had to go to the hospital, and he came out, and they jumped him. But when they went into his house, he had a loaded gun at every single window and door. And the big bay window in the living room, he had a tripod mounted 30 caliber. So, and he had video surveillance. So had we tried to engage the house, he would have just opened the blinds and just... a belt-fed gun. It's like,
wow.
And he would have taken out the whole team. Jeez. So, some of them can get pretty hairy.
Yeah.
You always go with your hunches. If you get a bad feeling, just
after
go with it.
After all that prep he got out because somebody told him you have to go to a hospital, that's all as bad as it's a publisher clearinghouse. You want $10 million?
Yeah.
Come on out.
Police have done that, though. Basically,
the fake lottery.
Yeah, yeah. Telling people, you want a TV, come down to Best Buy, and they send it to everyone who has a warrant. Hmm. And people are like, I want a TV. And then as soon as they go to Best Buy, there's one waiting.
I've seen those, yeah.
Should have done with that with the Brunch Divinians, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, that was a disaster.
So how is it?
Actually, my FBI instructor in sniper school was actually one of the ones shot during that.
Season. Really?
Yeah, he was shot in the behind.
Oh.
Yeah. Maybe that's why he specialized into snipers, so he could be farther away, but because he was right on the house then.
How is a, because most people, I only know it from TV, how is a SWAT team organized? I mean, they've got, the sniper,
mm-hmm.
And then, without giving it away to the bad guys.
Without giving any tactics away.
Yeah.
Everyone's cross-trained, at least in room entry and building clearing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a standard. Then you have a couple of different specializations. We have the control team, which is the snipers and spotters. Mm-hmm. You go out like in two-man teams. They are, like I said, the eyes for the team and to protect the team. Where if a precision shot needs to be made for like a hostage. We have the grenadiers who carry all the cool toys. They have smoke bombs, tear gas bombs, all different kind of grenades all over them. They're usually like, the ones who would have the shotgun at the rear of the line. Mm-hmm. But basically they're the ones who have all the kind of percussive and chemical weapons that you would bring in. And then you have the guys who are more just specialized into the room clearing and things like that.
Right.
And you have your team commander who basically sits in like a mobile unit on scene somewhere, and he just assesses all the information and determines where everyone's going to go. But it was neat because you have really cool equipment. You don't get it as a regular municipal officer. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I imagine.
Yeah.
Do you have any like fancy sci-fi stuff? Like, do they have is there a
sci-fi? Nothing sci-fi, but we do have cool stuff.
Is there like body cams that feed back to the truck or anything? Or is he working, is he working blind just by...
Yeah, he's going on audio. Well,
he's got like a maybe little diagram now. That yeah. he made out of...
Maybe
like,
not now. Now body cams are a big thing. Mm-hmm. So I've been off the team ever since I moved to the department I'm with now.
Okay.
So body cams become much bigger. So he probably does have a feed on that. But as far as like the coolest like gizmos that we have, we have night vision scopes that... because a lot of these calls take place at night. We have the Bearcat, which is the armored vehicle, which is
basically
a bulletproof Hummer kind of.
Yeah.
And that's what the team stays in. And that's equipped with a couple of cool things. One of them is the infrared, like the heat cameras.
Oh, yeah.
So you just, it's like a little turret on top, and you can look around and you can just see people hiding in bushes or even just like behind walls, that's not too thick.
Yeah.
That was one of the neatest things. Because we've had people that like have tried to get out of their house, like they'll sneak out of the basement window and try to like low crawl over to like their shed, and you got me like, wait a minute, we got someone going across the lawn. And you're like, thank God for this thing, because you'd never see him,
right?
You'd never see him.
But that came out of a Cracker Jack.
And we did have the good stuff with that, and we actually had one case where that came in really handy, and some young kid almost wound up getting himself shot. We actually had we were staging on a house where the guy, I think he had threatened to kill cops or something like that, but he was in the house and he was well known that he was a hunter. So he knows, how to stalk and how to go around. He got out through a basement window and we saw him go over toward like a wood pile toward the shed, and the Bearcat went around to get a better view. But then when they went around the wood pile, he was gone and they couldn't figure out where he went. And we're like, okay, he is not on the heat sensor anymore. He might've gotten out. So if he got out of our perimeter, he could technically be behind us. So now where everyone's like, okay, keep an eye behind you as well as forward, because God knows where he is. And then the heat seeking picked up someone low crawling up to our perimeter from behind. So right away, that puts us into, go mode. We're like, oh, here he comes. He's trying to double back on us. And we all converged on him. And it turned out to be an 18-year-old kid, saw all these cool vehicles and thing that, and he wanted to just get up close and see what was going on. And he almost wound up getting himself shot because we thought for sure he was coming to get us.
What happened to the guy?
He had actually, I think, gotten into his shed, which had so much stuff in there that kind of blocked his heat, but he had just gotten in there, and that's where he was hiding.
So if you want to do something like that, if you're a hoarder, that would be helpful.
Oh, I've been in hoarding houses since I've been on the job.
Oh my God. How many hoarding houses have you ever?
Too many.
Are you serious? Is that
too
bad?
Too many. Yeah.
I think a lot of people hoard.
Houses where you might have a 15-foot wide living room and it's only a trail to walk through because it's stacked up with newspapers and dirty clothes or God knows what else for 10 feet high. Mm-hmm. So you have to walk through trails to get from room to room because the room is just packed to the ceiling.
I knew a guy who did that. And he it was just shelving floor to ceiling. And then it was just like tiny little corridors through it.
Yeah.
Through the whole place.
Just enough to get through so you could throw some more stuff.
Well, what do they do with all that stuff? Why would you keep old newspapers?
I don't know.
I think there's different psychological
reasons.
Maybe
they like to build mazes.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe
they have
mice.
We had one call, not on SWAT or anything, but just a call. We were serving a warrant for a violent individual. And it was a hoarder house. Everything was piled up. So I look over once and there was a sofa ended here. And then there was the wall. So it was like the little corner area. And all I could see was this, just hair sticking up out of the trash. So I called for one of the guys. And he's like, got it. So we're like, all right, come on out. Don't make this worse than it has to be. And we're talking and nothing's happening. We're like, dude, we see you. We see you buried in this stuff. Like, this is going to get bad if you don't come out. Like, and nothing. So eventually one of the guys I was with took his flashlight and he turned it around. You have a pop, like right on top of the head, just to make the guy move. And it just sounded like a thud, like a hollow thud. What was that? So we started unburying. It was a mannequin. We just buried all the way up to here, just the top was sticking up. We're like, who has a mannequin like buried in their house? Yeah. But that's just, you just run into that kind of stuff. Just people just, anything they can find, they just bring home.
Jesus. You ever get lost in the house? Can't get out.
Not in a house, no.
You get a piece of cheese if you make it out.
There's a famous story about the Collier brothers in New York City. They had a huge mansion. You could get lost in it. And one of the brothers got really sick and was like lying around. Mm-hmm. And the other one was taking care of him. And he had built, they were rich. The place was junk, but they were rich. And one of the brothers had made like traps out of the newspapers, like piles of newspapers. And he triggered the trap and got stuck under it. Wow. He died. The other brother died because he wasn't taken care of. And eventually the cops came in and there was a Model T disassembled in their entryway and stuff like that. The pictures are intense.
Yeah.
But
you go, as a police officer, you go into a lot of houses and usually it's because something has happened. Maybe people can't take care of themselves, but I have been in houses where, there's dead rodents on the floor. Or
was that dinner or just?
They've been there a long time. Other houses where there's dog poo on the floor and you look at it and they see you looking at it and like, oh, sorry, I didn't get a chance to clean. Like, it's dust. It's like there's 20 piles and they're dust. They've been there for at least a month. Like you didn't get a chance to clean. But
I didn't know the police were coming.
That's the way people live. Like, just plates of food, just like a green mat of mold over the top of it, just on their living room table.
Oh.
Yeah, it's amazing like that.
How
people live
people
like that.
How do people actually manage to tie their shoes if you can't even have decency to clean the dog poo over the floor?
Right, of all the things to clean. I understand the hoarding more.
Velcro shoes.
I stepped in poo in someone's house, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't one of his pets. Oh. I think it was him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh man.
Yeah, you definitely see some horrible houses.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people who work in cities will see way worse, but we still get it. Just not as often, but we get it.
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk about something less offensive.
Yeah. So, any funny stories about a funeral direction?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Dead
funeral
bodies.
Directing stories. They were a long time ago. I'd have to think about that.
Anyone come back from the dead?
No one's ever come back from the dead. But I know I did. I did my first solo embalming on Halloween. And
By choice?
No, I just, my boss was like, all right, I'm gonna go get supplies. I'm gonna go. He's like, you know how to do this. So you take care of Mr. So-and-so. I'm like, okay. And I'm just thinking, like, it's Halloween. Like, and it's nighttime. I'm like,
trick or treat.
There's no way. So I'm like, so I spent half the time looking under, you know, the table, looking in the closets real fast, looking out the window. And you know, 2 or 3 hours later, he gets back. He's like, are you done? I'm like, no. He's like, why are you done? I'm like, I thought you were messing with me. I thought you were going to come back and like, who leaves me the first time on Halloween?
You at least bring your candy.
Yeah. We also, on my job now, we also had a dead body on Halloween. Like 12 o'clock, like on the nose, we get the call. You could see the guy in through the window and the doors, the front door is open. I'm like, no, no way. Like if this guy jumps, I'm going to punch. Like I was so like, this better not be a joke. And it wasn't, but like, I'm like, what are the chances?
So you have to go, you'd have to go get the body. From the
house. When I was a funeral director, we have to go to pick up the body at the house or the hospital, whatever the case, wherever it is. We bring it back and we do all the preparations. So I did embalming, I did makeup.
Did you do makeup?
I did hair. I was actually number one in my class in makeup.
Really?
Yeah, I was kind of a kiss ass. You get a mannequin head, and it's obviously it's a Caucasian head. Mm-hmm. You could tell because it's, you know, it's all one mold, so the hair, even part of the side, and you can tell by the features. But our teacher was black. So I'm like, I'm going to make mine black, but I'm going to make it look legitimate. Like, so I, with the shading, I tried to make the features look more African. And it looked good.
Yeah?
Yeah. But I had to like do like a swirl brush to make it look like the hair was curly and stuff like that. And I was taking a chance. I was like, oh, here we go. And I'm going to hand it to the teacher. She was like, all right, this is good. I'm like, oh, so I got an A.
It could have been either A.
It could have went the other way, but I'm like,
say like, you made your mannequin in black.
I'm like, you know what? That's terrible. Everyone else is doing it this way. I'm gonna take the chance here, and it actually turned out to be good. Yeah,
it's good. Well, it's kind of not funny, but a lot of times you go to wakes and it's open casket. Some people look actually the way they used to look, and some people look completely different. I'm like, that doesn't even look like the person I knew.
A lot of times, it's the guy who does the makeup. And I mean, all the bodies at funerals will have some makeup on. But it's usually like an old man doing the makeup and they're not really good at it. You know, so like they just put like too much rouge on or whatever and they don't look natural. It looks like you just made someone up, like a clown. And that's why I think I was one of the better ones in my class. I would just use as little makeup as possible. Like that looks ridiculous when you have someone like these bright rosy cheeks and like, you know, grandpa never wore makeup. He shouldn't look like he's wearing makeup now.
He's got lipstick and a red nose.
Yeah.
They usually look really pale, too. I mean, I guess that's inevitable.
Right. Unless you put too much on, then you can.
But maybe they should do more bronzer, like a Trump kind of thing.
The snooky
makeup. You could try it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you would imagine if you're really good at makeup, that's not the area that you go to. The real makeup.
You're not going
to
waste your talents on that.
Because that's not going to be.
If you're a top hairdresser, you're not going to do them on.
No repeat customers.
Unless you're goth, but in that case, you want the paleness anyways.
I did think of one funny story though, that it happened to one of the guys in my funeral service class in Northern Jersey, like Bergen County. It was a funeral for some guy who apparently had owed quite a bit of money to the mob.
Oh.
And some real big, thick neck kind of guy showed up at the funeral and he kneeled down in front of the open casket, and he took out a hat pin and he stuck him and the guy didn't flinch. So he's like, and then just left. He's like, I'm sorry for your loss. But he literally stuck him with a hat pin just to make sure he was dead. Cause he's like, yeah, this guy could be faking this. He owes us a lot of money.
Was the Godfather with a mirror?
Yeah. I mean, that probably would have been a nicer way.
Yeah. You just poke him.
Yeah. You a stick. Cause that guy's going to jump if it was real. Yeah. He told us about that. And we're like, what'd you do? And he's like, we didn't do nothing. He left and we were like, okay, it's fine. He's gone.
He's the one with the hat pin.
But then once you stab him, it's a buy. Like, do you want that pin? Yeah. You're dropping it.
That's your hat pin. That's the one you use on all the bodies.
Yeah, it's one you use on all the funerals.
Yeah. It's a professional tool.
Big deal. You're not going to give COVID to the next dead guy.
No, I guess not.
Yeah, and this was way before COVID. Way before.
He started it.
Yeah, you do get some funny ones in the funeral directing, but... it was more just silliness. I mean, like we had an Irish funeral where, because you're not allowed to drink or eat in a funeral home, we had this one Irish funeral where the guy was a big partier. And when he left, they just brought tons of booze and they kept it in the back of a pickup truck. Because I guess you could drink in the parking lot. So they would just take turns in teams of five and go out in the parking lot and just drink. And then they'd shut up the truck and come back in, another five would go out. And they would just sit there and party the whole time. And they buried him with a six pack and a cigar.
Trying to always destroy that Irish stereotype.
They really didn't do much to help that one, but they They were like, he was always a partier. He would have wanted it this way. Okay.
Hey, why not?
Seems appropriate.
Yeah.
So we're about an hour. Should we wrap it up? Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, because you know what? I think you should write a sequel and we can come back for the sequel.
There you go.
Or you could do that buddy cop movie that I talked about.
That actually would be a really good idea. Have like a social worker with it, because as a comedy, that would
That would be, especially now because they're looking for that. So all the Hollywood stuff is PC and they're all trying to be.
Yeah. You know. I mean, there's a lot that can go with it, because as I was speaking with that training, the social workers are not really ready for those cases that don't go well.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy when someone comes as a social worker to see you, you know, and they want to talk to you, but it's another thing when you go to their house and they're in the middle of a breakdown, or they're on drugs or God knows what else. And yeah, you can't deal with them. I mean, some of these people, they're talking about aliens and, you know, and government conspiracies and satellites watching them and so forth.
Yeah.
The microwaves talking.
Yeah. So
there's
really no talking them down.
Unless you have a intimate knowledge of their particular issue, you know, you're probably not going to get there very far.
Yeah, you just have to kind of agree with them. But when it's time to actually bring them to the hospital or bring them to jail, depending on, you know, what they've done or what the situation is, it doesn't usually go well.
Yeah.
And we've also had just people just flat out just, you know, you tell them, you're under arrest, you got to come with us. And they're like, do what you got to do. And they're just waiting for you. Like, you know, like one guy was a Golden Glove state champion. He's like, I'll give you the first punch. I'm not going anywhere. I'm like, crap. Like, this is going to be bad, you know, because like, you know the guy can fight. But, you know, this you're not going to talk him out of it. He's like, nope. He's like, I know exactly what you're doing and I'm not going.
Well, perks of the job. You get to be a Golden Glove state champion.
Yeah. We also have a former world contender. A boxer in our town.
Oh, nice.
And he's always been very good. We have had a couple times where, like, either he drank too much or, you know, it was a problem in his house and he didn't want to deal with us.
Which comes in, he's like, can you sign this?
Yeah. You're like, I know who you are. Like, I really don't want this to go badly.
Yeah. Well, it's a dangerous job. That's why it's, you know, I think you should be appreciated for a lot more than it is.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, no problem. And those books are for you guys, by the way.
Oh, you have a hard copy. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is actually my first podcast, so this was a learning experience for me. I had no idea what to expect.
Really. No, another fun episode. Anyways. It's great to be back live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After a few online and phone things.
Yeah.
But, thank you. So,
all right.
No problem.
We'll wrap it up.